Position your men accordingly, and you'll be able to grab them all with one swish of the net. Chapter 19. Kurt gathered his chips, left his winning table, and circled around the room, walking up behind Akiko. "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" he said. Then again, something tells me that's the wrong question. She froze at the sound of his voice, her back stiffening. "Card?" the dealer asked. Akiko did not respond. "Would you like a card?" "You have 16," Kurt told her. Akiko was playing blackjack. She refocused on the game and made the motion for another card instinctively. A red king gave her 26, and the dealer took her chips. "Now would be a good time to walk away," Kurt suggested, "and I'm not just talking about the game." She stood and brushed past Kurt without looking him in the eye. He followed, moving alongside her and matching her stride. "Aren't we on speaking terms anymore?" "You're going to interfere," she said. "With what?" She glanced at him. "How do you even know about this place?"
"A little bird told me. What about you?"
"This was my home," she said. "My prison."
Kurt grabbed her by the arm and turned her. "What are you trying to say?"
"I was owned by Kashimura," she replied bluntly. "It's nothing special. They own plenty of people. But I was property, and I did what they told me. You can imagine what I was used for. But as it turned out, I had a knack for fighting, and when a chance came to be more than a prostitute, I took it. I taught myself everything I could. I studied the martial arts, the samurai, the way of the warrior. A chance encounter led me to Master Kenzo, and when I had the opportunity, I left here and joined him. But they found me. They came after me."
Kurt was beginning to understand.
"You think that they found me," she repeated, "because I tried to escape them. They punished my new family. Kenzo tried to save me from myself, and now he's dead. So I'm going to make things right, even if I have to die to do it."
The story was something of a surprise, despite what Superintendent Nagano had told him. He wasn't altogether convinced, but there was great determination in her eyes.
"Kashimura," he said, "just to be sure, the man who runs this place." She nodded. "They don't like to lose their property, and they don't let people take things from them. I thought I was free, but I will never be free, so I will face my enemy and embrace him in death," she said. "If I was you, I wouldn't be seen with me. They might kill you for what I'm about to do."
A group of patrons came a little too close, and Kurt hustled Akiko onto the ramp that led upstairs. He was late for his meeting with Joe anyway.
"Listen to me," he said. "You're making a huge mistake. I spent a couple hours with the police the other day. Those men who attacked us were once part of the Yakuza, but not anymore. And they didn't attack the castle to get you back or make an example out of Kenzo. They were trying to stop him from giving us the information we came for." She looked at him as if she wanted to believe.
"Trust me," he said. "What happened was not your fault. It was our visit and what Kenzo found in the sea that caused the attack. It's connected to earthquakes and those Z-waves he found." She narrowed her gaze.
"These are the people I escaped from. I know their secrets, things they don't want coming to light."
Kurt shook his head. "If they remembered you, they'd have killed you the moment you walked in here. I'm telling you, you can let go of the guilt on this one."
"I don't know if I can accept that."
"Think about it on the cab ride home," he said. "You're leaving."
"Why?"
"In case they do recognize you." By now they'd reached the top floor and were nearing the piano alcove. Joe was nowhere to be found. But a distinct lack of music and the sight of staff members cleaning glass off the floor and rearranging the furniture suggested a commotion had taken place. Security members with earbuds talking to several guests confirmed it.
"Keep walking," he said, passing the alcove and the exit and continuing in the other direction.
I thought I was leaving. Kurt didn't look back. None of us are leaving. Not without finding our own way out. They continued down the hall and then back down one level toward the crowded casino pit. By the time they got there, screens were updating the list of fights to bet on. Joe's image and the false name he'd been provided with were now prominently displayed in the slot marked Fight One, the first bout of the evening. "What do those symbols mean?" Kurt asked. "That's for the weapons fight," she said. "Nunchucks, staffs, half-staffs. 7 3-minute rounds or until either combatant cannot rise. No submission." All thoughts of finding Ushioni or whoever paid him vanished as Kurt's mind turned to a different problem. "I'm going to need your help."
"To do what?"
"Rescue Joe." Chapter 20 Kurt and Akiko moved through the crowd as the lights came on in the arena. "How soon till the fight begins?" Kurt asked.
20 minutes, she said.
All around the casino floor, bettors were gathering up their chips and making their way to the exhibition. Kurt continued to move with the crowd. Akiko was with him, but slowing down.
"Stay with me."
"You can't go to the arena," she said. "That's what they want you to do." "I'm going," he said, "but not the way they expect. First, we have to get out of sight." A hidden door opened in the far wall and a cocktail waitress stepped through it with a tray of drinks. "Back of the house," Kurt said. "Every hotel has one." He led Akiko toward it, pulled up beside the smooth section of the wall, and waited. It wasn't long before the door swung wide and another waitress came out. She passed them without a second glance, navigating through the crowd toward a table. By the time the door clicked shut, Kurt and Akiko had slipped inside. They entered an unadorned service hall. A drink station lay in one direction, empty locker rooms in the other. With the sound of footsteps coming down the hall, Kurt angled toward one of the locker rooms, slipped inside, and closed the door. When the steps in the hall passed by, Kurt knew they were alone. "You came here looking for revenge," he said. "What was your plan?" She pulled a small plastic vial from a hidden pouch in her dress. Opening the top, she produced several white tablets.
"Poison," she said. "Slow acting. It would give me enough time to get out before taking effect. No one would ever know who did it."
"Mind if I borrow that?" he asked. She placed the pills back inside and handed it over.
"Do you think that will help?"
"I'd prefer an AK-47, he said. "But this will be easier to smuggle, especially considering the wardrobe requirements of the night."
"You seem very certain," she said.
"I am," he insisted. "All we have to do is take our complaints to the manager. I think he'll see things our way. But to reach him, we'll need to blend in. If you'd be so kind as to put on a cocktail server's uniform, that would be a start." Akiko opened several lockers before finding the right uniform, and then began to disrobe without a hint of modesty. Kurt turned his back to her to give her some privacy and went through several of the lockers before he found what he was looking for. Another bottle of pills. He slipped it into his pocket and turned around.
"Aren't you going to change?" she asked.
"Not just yet," he said.
"That white jacket stands out," she said. "They'll spot you as soon as you walk up."
"I'm counting on it." In a different locker room, down below the arena, Joe was told to dress for the fight. The pickings were slim, different types of athletic gear and martial arts robes.
"I don't suppose you have anything in suit of armor? Say, early Middle Ages?"
The joke was wasted on his captors. They'd been ordered by Kashimura to get him ready for the fight and force him into the arena if he refused to go willingly. Other than that, they weren't to speak with him. With little choice, Joe picked out a two-piece martial arts uniform. The loose gray top had a V-neck collar. The pants had an elastic waistband, designed for ease of movement. Several weapons were offered for him to practice with. He picked up a set of nunchucks and whirled them about left and right. He'd toyed with nunchucks once before, but without professional training, they were as dangerous to the user as to the opponent.
After almost hitting himself in the face, he put them down. The noise of the crowd reached them through the closed door. It rose and fell as a voice speaking in Japanese announced the coming bout. "It's time," one of the guards said. They marched him to the door and held him in place. The door opened to a roar from the crowd and a wave of blinding light. Joe squinted as they pushed him forward and forced him to ascend a ramp. He stepped into a circular arena with a 6-foot wall around it. It reminded Joe of a bullfighter's ring, except that the floor was made of wooden planking, complete with dark swaths where it had been stained with blood.
"That's encouraging," he muttered. "You guys should bet on me," Joe said to the guards in his corner. "I'm sure you'll get good odds."
Neither of them responded, and when Joe's opponent arrived from a gap in the far wall, Joe understood why. The man was a monster, 6'7" and muscle-bound from head to toe. Huge rounded shoulders tapered to a washboard abdomen and then widened out on a pair of tree-trunk-sized legs.
"Never mind," Joe said. "I wouldn't bet on me either."
The guards behind him snickered, but Joe couldn't have been happier. He knew he wasn't alone. Some way, somehow, Kurt would try to rescue him. All he had to do was stay alive long enough for Kurt to do it. And in that situation, a big, slow bruiser of an opponent would be far easier to hold off than a quick-hitting martial artist. Joe was pushed to the center of the ring. Weapons were offered. Joe took a staff, like the one he'd used to vault over the Komodo dragon. The Japanese version of Hercules took a pair of sticks, one in each hand. A horn sounded, and the bout began. Joe held the staff in front of him as the giant moved in without hesitation. Joe jabbed at him a few times with the point of the staff, slowing his approach. His opponent took the first two in the ribs and shrugged them off as if they were nothing. He responded to the third jab with a vicious counterattack. Displaying incredible speed for such a big man, he brought the left-handed stick down and knocked the point of Joe's staff into the floorboards, while simultaneously lunging forward and swinging the other half-staff toward Joe's skull. Joe ducked just in time, hearing a distinct whistling noise as the stick passed over his head. The crowd let out a collective gasp, and Joe pulled back, resuming his defensive stance.
"Take it easy, big fella," he said. "At least give the people a show before you cave my head in."
He might as well have been talking to a wall. The man neither smiled nor frowned. He just charged forward once again. This time Joe dropped to the ground, shoved the staff between his opponent's legs, and levered it to the side. The big man's knees buckled from the attack, and he dropped to the ground. Instead of injuring the man, Joe's next move was to disarm the guy. He swung his staff like a 9-iron, catching one of the sticks in his adversary's hand and sending it into the third row. Patrons dove out of their seats to avoid the incoming missile, and Joe laughed at them. The sideshow gave his opponent a chance to stand. Joe hoped the man realized he'd deliberately gone for his weapon instead of his head. Before they could spar again, the horn sounded, signaling the intermission between rounds. The big guy returned to his starting area and was briefly tended to. Joe went back to his spot, but the guards just stared at him. He grabbed a bottle of water for himself, took a small drink, and rested against the wall. For the first time, he was able to study the crowd. It was an intimate setting, seating for maybe 1,000 people. They surrounded him on steeply sloped tiers, and every seat was taken. He looked for Kurt, but found no sign of him. What he did see were security guards standing at every entrance and in each aisle. There was no way Kurt could get into the arena without being caught, a fact Kurt had no doubt already discovered. It meant Joe would have to keep fighting while Kurt found another way. The horn sounded for round two. Joe put the water down and stepped forward.
"Make it quick," he whispered. "I can't dance with Godzilla forever."
Chapter 21 In a luxury suite overlooking the arena, Walter Hahn watched the fight from behind thick glass. It muffled the sound of the crowd and the viciousness of the blows, and allowed a sense of privacy. Scanning the arena through a pair of opera glasses, he saw nothing to indicate a rescue was underway.
Anything? Kashimura asked.
Not yet, Han said.
So much for your plan to draw him out into the open, Kashimura said condescendingly.
Han placed the glasses down and began to pace. The arrival of the American unnerved him, not only because he'd been told they were all dead or in the hospital, but because they'd struck so close to him. He had a survivor's instincts, and they told him he was in danger. He explained what he knew to Kashimura.
Based on the description your doorman gave, you're looking for a man named Austin. He'll be wearing a distinctive white dinner jacket. The man in the ring is his comrade. Considering what I know about these two, neither will abandon the other.
Kashimura smirked. Bravado. I find it goes out the window when the stakes get this high. If Austin knows what's good for him, he's already looking for a way out of the building.
An effort I assume your men will prevent, Han said.
Of course, Kashimura said. Trust me, there's no way for them to escape now.
Han nodded. Then I'll depart and let you handle it.
You're leaving.
Han knew it wasn't his finest moment, but he had to get out of there. If he was exposed, the entire plan would come apart, and the leaders of the party in China would sacrifice him to save themselves.
What purpose does my staying serve? You said it yourself. There's no way for them to escape.
Kashimura had been trapped by his own words.
If this goes badly for us, you will hear about it, he threatened.
You forget your station, Han said. I deal with those much higher in the syndicate than you. My patronage is appreciated and has been for years. He put his hand on the door, not waiting for permission. If the American has friends here, I expect you to find them and eliminate them. If not, get rid of the one in the ring and leave no trace of his existence.
Kashimura bristled, but did not try to prevent his leaving.
Take the wild man with you, he said. Don't ever bring him here again.
Han opened the door and motioned to Oni. They left together. Kashimura remained behind, stewing for the moment and frustrated. He grabbed the opera glasses off the table and scanned the arena himself. He saw nothing out of order and lowered the glasses, pointing to his empty tumbler as a cocktail waitress entered.
Scotch.
He sat down in an overstuffed chair as she freshened his drink and delivered it. Without acknowledging her, he brought the glass to his mouth, tipped it back, and consumed half the liquid inside. The fiery liquid burned in just the right way, and Kashimura felt instantly calmer. He put the tumbler down and turned his attention back to the fight. The second round had gone much like the first, the hulking giant attacking and the nimble American dodging and weaving.
Maybe Han is right, he said to himself. Perhaps he is waiting for rescue.
Then we'd better not disappoint him, a voice said from behind them. Kashimura whirled in his chair. The American accent was unmistakable, the white dinner jacket confirming who it was that had spoken. Kashimura noticed the man was unarmed, but smiling.
You must be Austin.
I am, the man replied, taking a seat.
How did you get in here?
With surprising ease, Austin replied smugly. Now that most of your men are out there looking for me, the hallways are empty, and your guards at the door were easy to distract and subdue.
I don't need guards to protect myself, Kashimura said, producing a snub-nosed pistol and aiming it at the American's chest.
Instead of fear or even caution, Austin merely raised his hands in a half-hearted manner, as if he were surrendering. He wore an outright grin on his face, not the look of a defeated man.
I wouldn't pull that trigger if I was you.
You'll wish I had when you're drowning at the bottom of Tokyo Bay with your friend.
And you'll wish you'd listened to me, the American replied,
When your heart goes into an uncontrollable fibrillation and your arteries begin leaking blood out of every pore and body cavity.
What are you talking about?
Whatever happens to me happens to you, Austin told him. Either we both live or we both die. It's up to you.
Lies and a bad attempt to bluff. That doesn't work well around here.
Austin held up an empty plastic vial and tossed it to him. Kashimura caught it with his free hand. A bitter residue clung to the sides.
That was filled with heparin, Kurt said. A powerful blood thinner, very similar to rat poison.
You've ingested a fatal dose in that beverage of yours. Enough to kill a man 3 times your size. Like the one trying to beat up my friend down there. The alcohol masks the taste of the drug. But I imagine you can detect a metallic and bitter flavor on your tongue at this point.
Kashimura began running his tongue across his teeth. He detected an unpleasant essence. He knew what rat poison could do. He'd used it on others.
You're probably feeling flushed as well, Austin continued. Your heart will be racing soon, if it's not already.
Kashimura's face felt warm. His heart was beating firmly. A little too firmly. A bead of sweat was already forming on his brow.
You'll never get out of here alive, he said.
Austin raised an eyebrow. I will if you escort me to the door.
And if you're willing to do that, I'm willing to leave you at the front gate with a firm handshake and the antidote in your outstretched palm.
Or I could shoot you and search your body for it.
Kashimura cocked the pistol and stared down the barrel.
Excellent idea, Austin said. He opened his palm, revealing a handful of tablets. There were 5 pills, all of different colors, shapes, and sizes.
It's one of these, he said. But you guess wrong, you get more poison, and you die even quicker.
Kashimura could hardly believe what was occurring. In the heart of the Yakuza stronghold, with every exit sealed and 50 armed men looking for him, Austin had turned the tables against the house.
Put the gun on the floor and slide it over here, Austin demanded.
He shook his head. There had to be another way.
Austin glanced at his watch.
Wait much longer and it'll be too late.
Kashimura tried to control his fear, but it was overwhelming. His heart was pounding now. A sheen of sweat had built up on his face. He wiped his face with the sleeve of his jacket and put the gun down. He kicked it Austin's way.
What do you want me to do? Call off the security teams?
Austin picked up the pistol.
They would find that awfully suspicious.
Then what?
First, I'll take your phone, he said. Mine was impounded. And then you're going to help me get my friend out of the ring. And you're going to do it the old-fashioned way. By hand.
Chapter 22
The horn blew, and round 4 began. Joe noticed a new tactic from his opponent. The man was no longer charging forth, trying to land a deadly blow. Instead, he was hanging back, waiting for Joe to move first. Perhaps he was tiring. Or maybe it was a new tactic born out of Joe's ability to evade him.
Joe looked his opponent in the eye. The man waved Joe forward, daring him to move closer. Joe shook his head.
The big man repeated his gesture, swinging the remaining stick in the air as if to challenge him. Still, Joe held his ground, and the fight turned into a stalemate. With the combatants circling each other instead of attacking, the crowd began to whistle. Soon a chant began. Joe didn't understand the words, but he felt the intensity growing. The ground began to move under his feet, not side to side, but vertically. The outside edge of the circular ring was rising up, the planks being lifted by a hydraulic jack. A small section in the middle remained flat, but that was it. What had been a large circular arena, with plenty of room to move about in, began transforming into a funnel that would force the warriors into close combat. The big guy smiled at this development and walked calmly down to the center of the funnel.
Joe held his position,
crouching as the angle of the floor grew steeper. He dropped lower to keep his center of gravity down, put a hand on the floor to keep himself balanced, but as the angle passed 45 degrees, his feet began to slip. The crowd was chanting deliriously now, anticipating the moment Joe would fall and tumble into the arms of the giant. Joe knew he couldn't hold on much longer. At any moment, the friction holding him in place would be overcome by the force of gravity. Instead of remaining still and trying to hold off the inevitable, he leapt up and ran. But he didn't run straight at his opponent. He ran at an angle, cutting across the funnel and down. Picking up momentum, he was able to curve back up the opposite slope like a speeding car on a banked turn. The big man swept at his feet, but Joe leapt over the attack and then whacked his oversized opponent in the back of the head as he passed him. The big man fell with a heavy thud as Joe ran up the far side of the banked platform. He was about to make another high-speed attack when the bottom dropped out. Literally. The pneumatic hiss told the story, but Joe heard it too late. Large valves had been opened, and the pent-up pressure holding the floor panels up released. The floorboards fell back to their original state, and Joe fell with them, slamming against the solid ground. Stunned, he rolled over. That's just not fair. He looked up to see his opponent rushing in. The muscle-bound specimen of a man grabbed the staff and pulled it out of Joe's hand. Almost immediately, it came swinging back Joe's way with deadly force. Joe covered up. His natural instinct as a boxer was to bring his left arm up to protect his head. The stick crashed against Joe's flexed bicep and forearm, but still caught the side of his head with a glancing blow. His legs felt like jelly. A voice in his head told him to get up and run, but it was drowned out by the ringing sound in his ears. He tried for a crawling position before falling to his side and then rolling over on his back. He lay that way, staring straight up. There was no ref to count him out, only the blinding glare of the lights up above. A perfect square of incandescence with an impenetrably dark section in the center. For a second, the giant stood over Joe, blocking the light. But the horn sounded, and the big man walked off rather than attempting to finish Joe. Chivalry isn't dead after all, Joe said to himself. As he lay there waiting for the feeling to return to his legs, something fell toward him from up above. At first, Joe thought it was his imagination, but it hit the deck next to him, bounced, and then rolled in a curved path until it bumped against his ribs. He turned on his side, innate curiosity driving him to see what had fallen from the rafters. Grasping it with his fingers, he plucked the object from the floor. It was a 5-yen coin, with its brassy color and hole in the middle. A token of good luck. Joe's spirits soared. He looked back up to the rafters, just as the bank of overhead lights went out. Chapter 23 Throw him the rope, Kurt called. He, Akiko, and Kashimura were perched on the catwalk that ran between the lights. Akiko had a long nylon cord used to secure things to the catwalk. She dropped one end over the side, allowing it to fall straight down. It hit the canvas in the dark. I hope he sees it, she said. After that last hit, he might not be thinking clearly. If there's anything harder than a diamond, it's Joe's head, Kurt told her. He'll be all right. Kurt had seen Joe grasp the coin and look up. He knew Joe would put it together. Once he's up here, you give me the antidote, Kashimura said anxiously. Not until we're outside, Kurt replied. The rope went taut. Two pulls told them Joe was ready. Now, Kurt said, pull him up. The three of them began hauling on the rope, arm over arm. With synchronized strokes that would have done a yacht crew proud, they lifted Joe off the ground. But it was a long way up to the lighting array, and Joe weighed nearly 200 pounds. Halfway up, Kashimura stopped. He dropped to a knee, clutching at his chest. He was sweating feverishly. I need the antidote. Get back on the rope, Kurt shouted. Not unless you give me the pills. There wasn't much Kurt could do. Joe was a lot heavier without Kashimura hauling in tandem. If Kurt let go, Akiko would be hard-pressed to hold him all by herself. "I'll give you the pills as soon as he's up here. Now pull!" With Kurt frozen, Kashimura lunged at him, thrusting his hand into Kurt's pocket and fishing around for the pills. The impact almost knocked them both over the railing. The rope slipped, Joe dropped a few feet, and Kurt gripped it again. "Give me the antidote!" Kashimura screamed. Kurt didn't bother to respond. He pushed Kashimura back against the rail, wrapped the other end of the rope around him, and pushed him over. The bulky mobster was not particularly nimble, but in desperation, he managed to hook one foot around the railing. He stopped his fall. He and Joe were now balancing each other out. Kurt pulled out the orange tablets. "This is what you want."
"Please,"
Kashimura said. "One question first," Kurt said. "Who paid Ushioni?"
"What?"
Kurt reared back as if to throw the tablets into the dark.
"Wait," Kashimura pleaded. "It was Han."
"Han who?"
"Walter Han."
"Is he Yakuza?"
"No," Kashimura said. "He's a Chinese businessman. Very wealthy."
Kurt pressed, though there was little time to do so. "Why would a businessman hire an assassin?"
"I don't know."
Kurt let a little of the rope out.
"I swear it," Kashimura shouted. "Now give me the pills."
Flashlights were probing around down below as security members tried to figure out what had gone wrong with the lights. Time for questions had run out. Kurt dropped the pills over the side. "You'll find them in the arena," he said. "Have a nice trip down." With that, he knocked Kashimura's foot from the railing. The heavy mobster, still entangled in the rope, fell, but slowly, as he was balanced out by Joe's weight. He hit the ground with a soft thud, freed himself, and immediately began looking for the orange pills. Up above, Kurt and Akiko helped Joe over the railing.
"Thanks for the lift," Joe said. "Did I see someone else dropping down the other side, or am I hallucinating?"
"Just getting rid of some dead weight," Kurt said.
"Dead weight and our ticket out of here," Akiko said.
Joe stared at her and blinked.
"Akiko?
That guy must have hit me harder than I thought." "I'll explain later," Kurt said. "First, we need to create a distraction. Give me that fire extinguisher." Akiko picked up a red-painted tank and handed it over to Kurt. It was a dry chemical fire extinguisher. Kurt pulled out the cotter pin, compressed the handle, and tossed the extinguisher over the edge. It fell in what seemed like slow motion, trailing white vapor and hitting the arena below like a bomb.
"Fire!"
Akiko yelled in Japanese.
"Fire!"
The flashlights down below converged on the billowing cloud. In the dim glow, it looked like smoke. The nervous crowd erupted into chaos, and people began running in every direction. "Let's go," Kurt said. They moved along the catwalk and climbed through the access door in the far wall. From there, they entered a maintenance tunnel. At a Y-shaped junction, they turned right, found another door, and pushed out into the night. By now, the lights were coming on behind them. People were rushing out every door. Cars were headed for the main gate. "I don't suppose you brought a car," Kurt said to Akiko. "Maybe one of those classic automobiles from Kenzo's collection?"
"No,"
she said,
"but we could steal one."
Kurt looked toward the main gate. There was too much commotion. The security guards were out and the driveway was turning to gridlock.
"Can't risk it,"
Kurt said. "They'll be looking at every car that leaves the premises. We need to exit without saying our goodbyes. Follow me." He led them away from the structure and out into the dark of the ornamental garden.
"They may have cameras out here," Joe said.
"No one left in the security bullpen to watch them," Kurt replied. "But let's get to the fence and get over it as soon as possible."
"Then what?"
Akiko asked. "We flag down a passing car. Hopefully something high-end with plenty of headroom."
"A Bentley would be nice," Joe said.
Kurt smiled in the dark.
"My thoughts exactly."
They crossed the grounds and reached the 12-foot iron fence. Kurt pulled out the phone he'd stolen off of Kashimura. He dialed a number from memory and waited for an answer. He started speaking the moment Nagano picked up.
"This is Kurt. We're on the west side of the property, by the fence near the access road. Can you pick us up?"
"I'm down the road," Nagano said.
Cars are streaming past. What happened?
I'll explain when you get here, Kurt said. But make it quick, or they'll feed us to the koi.
Kurt heard the Bentley's engine roaring over the phone. It was a comforting sound. With the phone back in his pocket, he reached for the bars of the wrought iron fence.
Don't! Joe shouted.
Kurt turned and saw Joe pointing to well-disguised wires looping in and out of the hollow crossbar.
Electrified?
Looks that way, Joe said.
The second wire could be tied to a sensor. One way or another, if we touch the fence, they're going to know where we are.
Kurt looked back toward the main building. He could hear dogs barking and see flashlight beams playing across the grounds.
They're going to figure it out soon enough anyway. Can you short it out?
Joe was looking for a weak point.
Not the way they've set it up.
They're coming, Akiko said.
So was Nagano. Far down the access road, a pair of headlights swung into the lane. Kurt could hear the big engine of the Bentley growling as it rushed toward them. He got on the phone again.
We're trapped behind an electric fence. You're our only hope to get out. The lower part of the fence is a brick foundation. You need to knock a hole in it for us to crawl under.
The Bentley was closing in, as were the dogs and the security guards.
I see you, Nagano said. Stand back.
Kurt waved Joe and Akiko back from the fence as the Bentley slowed down, swung wide, and then turned toward the barricade, accelerating once again. It hit the barrier like a 3-ton hammer, bending the iron bars and, more importantly, blasting a 2-foot gap in the brick foundation. A cloud of dust swirled, lit by the Bentley's high beams. The flashlights from the guards converged on them, and the dogs were released. They sprinted forward in a yelping pack.
Go! Kurt shouted.
Nagano pulled the Bentley free, shoving a few stray bricks aside. Joe crawled through. Akiko followed, and Kurt dove through right behind her. By the time he got to his feet, Joe and Akiko were getting into the car and the dogs were bounding down the hill. Kurt rushed forward, pulled the front door open as the pack of dogs made it to the fence and charged underneath. He jumped inside and slammed the door behind him, closing it against a flash of canine teeth.
Get us out of here!
Nagano had already stepped on the gas. The Bentley spun its tires in the gravel and charged off in a cloud of dust, leaving the guards and the barking dogs far behind.
I hope this isn't a one-way road, Joe said.
Not to worry, Nagano replied. It comes out on a secondary highway. We should have no problems.
Kurt sat up and looked through the tinted back window.
Anyone following us?
Not that I can see, Nagano replied, looking in the mirror.
Joe and Akiko popped up, blocking the view.
This is most peculiar, Nagano said. I remember dropping off 2 passengers, fully clothed. I've picked up 3, and one of you is wearing pajamas. Please tell me all this commotion is not because one of you kissed the wrong woman.
Not this time, Joe said.
Kurt cut in. Superintendent, allow me to introduce Akiko. Akiko, this is Superintendent Nagano of the Japanese Federal Police. I believe he's been looking for you. A scowl crossed her face, but she said nothing. Nagano was quiet as well, but began to laugh softly.
It must have been quite an evening.
That it was, Kurt said. It's not every day you win 10 million yen, find a beautiful woman, and rescue your best friend from certain death, only to be chased by men with guns and dogs.
Don't believe a word of it, Joe said. That stuff happens with alarming regularity around here.
Akiko glanced at Joe and then looked back to Kurt. Her lips curled into a smile, and she laughed softly. It was the first sign of mirth Kurt had seen from her.
Don't forget, she added, we also poisoned a high-ranking Yakuza leader.
Terrific, Joe said. That should add to our life expectancy.
We never actually poisoned him, Kurt said. I found a bottle of caffeine pills in the locker room. People who have to be on their feet for 10 hours a day tend to use those kind of stimulants.
Akiko crushed up 5 of them and dumped them in his drink. Between the caffeine rush and the power of suggestion, he probably felt like his heart was going to blow.
He may still want revenge, Nagano warned.
Not likely, Kurt said. Otherwise he'd have to tell everyone that he helped us escape. Across from Kurt, Nagano nodded.
Considering what it's going to cost me to repair this car,
I hope you accomplished more than upsetting the Yakuza. Kurt grew serious. We found out who paid for the attack. A Chinese businessman named Han. Nagano glanced at Kurt.
Walter Han?
As he spoke the name, the superintendent's voice was half an octave deeper than normal.
No, no, no. Surely you misunderstood.
I heard what I heard, Kurt said. He paid Ushioni to attack Kenzo's castle.
It makes no sense, Nagano insisted.
Why?
Joe asked.
Who is he?
Han is a high-tech magnate, Nagano said, an industrialist whose companies build aircraft parts and machinery. They sell advanced robotics systems to factories here and in China. He's been a powerful voice suggesting China and Japan should end centuries of suspicion and begin working together. This is a man who spends time with prime ministers and presidents, not rubbing shoulders with the Yakuza.
Then where would one of those Yakuza bosses get the name? Kurt asked.
A fabrication, Nagano said. He must have made it up.
It's a rather unusual name to pull out of thin air, Joe said. Half Western, half Chinese.
Han has been in the news lately, Nagano said. He was at a state dinner the other night. He's opening a new production facility in Nagasaki this week. He's going to be there for the signing of the new cooperation agreement between Japan and China.
You're suggesting Kashimura gave me this name because he saw Walter Han on TV.
Possibly.
Kurt considered that and then shook his head.
I'm not buying it. A funny thing happens in moments of extreme duress. The mind reverts to its most primitive desire, survival. And considering the predicament Kashimura was in at that moment, I'd bet his only thought was to save his skin.
Nagano went quiet again.
Well, if you're right, this is very bad news, he said finally. It means our investigation is at an end.
Why?
Joe asked.
Han is beyond my reach, the superintendent said. He has dual citizenship and friends in the highest places. Between that and his money, he enjoys a type of unofficial diplomatic immunity. For me to launch an investigation would be pointless. It would be closed down by those above me, and I would be reassigned to guard duty at an abandoned station in the mountains.
So he's untouchable, Kurt said.
Nagano looked pained, but resolute.
I'm afraid so. What if Ushioni rolled over on him,
Joe said.
With two different members of the Yakuza implicating Han, your superiors would be afraid not to investigate.
Perhaps, Nagano said. But that brings us back to square one. Finding Ushioni. We still don't know where to look. And after this, he will vanish like the wind.
Not if you activate your tracking network, Joe said, since he's carrying one of the coins.
All eyes turned Joe's way.
While Kurt was goofing around and playing cards, I was actually working.
Kurt raised an eyebrow.
As I recall, you were fighting for your life in the Ring of Doom, and I was rescuing you.
Ah, yes, Joe said. But how do you think I ended up down there?
Someone must have recognized you.
Someone did, Joe said. Ushioni. As much as I hate to admit it, he got the jump on me. But once I stopped him from giving me a complimentary tracheotomy, I realized he'd given me the perfect chance to tag him. So while we wrestled, I slipped the coins into his pocket, assuming he hasn't tossed them in a wishing well. You should have no problem following him now.
Kurt offered a bow of respect to his friend.
I stand corrected and duly impressed.
As am I, Nagano said.
We'll help you bring him in, Kurt offered.
No, Nagano replied. You've done enough already. Ushioni is too dangerous. I cannot have your blood on my hands as it almost was tonight. I will bring a few of my men into it. We'll track Ushioni and take him as soon as possible.
All right, Kurt said. You have your lead and we have ours. I hope you won't stop us from looking into Mr. Han's activities.
Nagano shook his head.
Like I said, you'll find him in Nagasaki.
He's scheduled to speak at the opening of his facility on the waterfront the day after tomorrow.
Be careful. At the very least, he's a powerful man with friends in several nations.
But if he did hire Ushioni, he's more dangerous than I would have imagined.
Chapter 24. Osaka to Shanghai Ferry, East China Sea. Gemme Trout picked her way through the narrow hall on the main deck of the Osaka to Shanghai ferry, squeezing past people, stacks of luggage, and other items that lined the passageway. Because the journey was relatively short, and most of the passengers relatively poor, cabins were shared by multiple groups. Often 6 or 8 people were in a room that would barely fit 2 on a standard Caribbean cruise ship. This morning, the halls were particularly crowded as passengers who might have gone for fresh air on the upper deck remained inside, courtesy of gray skies and an icy rain. Making it back to her cabin, she found Paul sitting at a desk that was entirely too small for him.
"How's it going?"
Paul was hunched over a chart, plotting their position.
"I've figured out where we are, but I was starting to wonder where you'd gotten to."
"I had to navigate by memory," she said. "None of the signs are in English." She handed him a cup of hot liquid.
"Coffee?"
"Green tea," she replied. "It's all they had." Paul took the cup with a disappointed look on his face.
"It's good for you," Gamay said.
He nodded.
"How do things look up top?"
"No one on deck," she told him. "Too cold and miserable to be outside."
"That's one thing in our favor," Paul said. "We're only a few miles from the target zone, closer than I thought we'd be. We should probably wake up the Remora and make sure all systems are go."
"I'll get to it." Gamay settled in and turned on her laptop while Paul opened the cabin's window. Brisk air poured in, freshening the room.
"Who needs coffee when you have salt air?" Gamay said.
"Me, for one," Paul said. Standing beside the window, he removed a tightly wound bundle of cable from their luggage. With a twist of his hand, he attached a waterproof transmitter to the end and began feeding the cable through the open window. It slid down the side of the ship, drifting back with the wind until it eventually reached the sea.
"Transmitter is in the water," Paul said. "Let's hope no one looks out the window and wonders what this black wire is doing on the outside of the ship."
"I wouldn't worry about it," Gamay said. "As far as I can tell, every passenger on this ship is congregated in the hall. I'm ready to transmit."
"All clear."
She tapped away at the keyboard and sent a signal to the Remora, commanding it to power up. After a short delay, she was rewarded with a signal from the ROV and the appearance of a remote command screen on her computer. It looked like a video game display, with virtual controls and dials across the bottom, and a forward-looking camera view across the top. A bank of indicators on the right side of the screen displayed readings from the magnetometer and other sensors. "All systems green," she said, disconnecting from the hull. At the touch of a button, the electromagnets in the Remora's hull shut off, and the ROV pitched down, diving to the right and away from the ferry's spinning propellers. Turbulent water could be seen on the screen until the Remora cleared the ship's wake.
"What's the new course?" Gemme asked.
"The target area is almost directly south of us," Paul said, glancing at his chart. "Set a heading of 190. Gemme punched in the course, adjusted the dive angle, and let the Remora do the rest. They were 3 miles from the target zone. It would take nearly 20 minutes to get there.
"Better hope the batteries are charged."
Paul grinned. "First thing I checked when we picked it up at the airport." With little to do as the submarine moved through the dark, Gamay began flicking through the instrument readings. Almost immediately, she noticed something odd.
"Check this out," she said.
Paul leaned closer.
"What am I looking at?"
"Based on the speed setting, the Remora is traveling through the water at 11 knots, but its position marker is barely making 7. We're fighting a current."
"Shouldn't be," Paul said, looking at his charts. "Considering our location and the time of year, the current should be in our favor, giving the Remora a push to the south."
"Maybe so," she said, "but we've got the nautical equivalent of a 4-knot headwind."
"That might explain why we've been traveling north of the shipping lane for the last 4 hours instead of on the south side. Anything on the bottom profile yet?"
Gamay pressed another key. A graphic display of the seafloor beneath the remora appeared. Flat as a pancake. So much for my mountain range theory. We're still a few miles from the target zone. Paul shook his head. If there was a new range growing up down there, I'd expect to see ridges and folding in the outer sedimentary layers, and we'd certainly detect a mild upslope. Gemme studied the readout for any sign of what Paul was describing, but she saw nothing to suggest a change in elevation. Let's let it play out before we go back to the drawing board. Not much else we can do, Paul said. Gemme sat back, reaching for her cup of tea with one hand and tapping the keyboard with the other. Lazily, she cycled through a host of other readings. Virtual topography, water temperatures, and salinity levels. The computer organized the information into a series of displays and graphs. But the data made no sense. Something's wrong with the instruments, she said, putting the teacup down. Why do you say that? According to the temperature profile, it's getting warmer as the remora goes deeper. Paul glanced over her shoulder. Have you passed through a thermocline? No, she said. No sudden change, just a slow, steady increase, approximately 1 degree for every 70 feet. That indicates a continuous mixing instead of boundary layer. What about the salinity? Paul asked. Gemme tapped the key to bring up another sensor reading. Even more screwed up than the temperature profile. According to this, the salinity is decreasing as we descend. That can't be right. Can you run a diagnostic on the sensor probes? Gemme didn't know enough about the ROV to diagnose a problem with the sensors, let alone fix it remotely. Maybe if Joe was here, she said. All I got was a rudimentary lesson on driving the thing. Bring it back up, Paul suggested. Not all the way, just 100 feet or so. What good will that do? If the sensors are failing, the temperature will continue to rise, he said. But if they're working properly and we are actually dealing with an inverted temperature profile, the water should grow colder again. Sneaky, she said. I like it. Gemme changed the dive angle and put the ROV into an ascent. Temperature dropping. Salinity rising. The sensors are working correctly. Now what? Resume course, Paul said. Satisfied, but confused, Gemme adjusted the dive profile once more and sent the remora back toward the deep. She had it level off at a depth of 500 feet so they could map a wide section of the bottom before investigating up close. Still flat, Gemme noted. Amazing, he said. I've gotten shirts back from the dry cleaner that aren't that smooth. So no mountain range, Gemme said, but temperature and salinity data that defy logic. Any thoughts? Not at the moment, Paul said. He glanced at the chart. You're nearing the epicenter of Kenzo's earthquakes. Change course to the west. She made the adjustments, and the readout changed. We're picking up something new. Ridges and hills, he said hopefully. Sorry, Charlie, it's a depression. It looks like a subsurface canyon. The information on the chart suggested a flat plain, but as the remora's sonar bounced off the seafloor, a deep V-shaped gash was revealed. The point of the V was aimed like an arrow at Shanghai. Let's take a look at that chasm. Gemme was already changing course and directing the sub into the gap. Temperature continuing to rise, she said. Salinity continues to drop. It defied all logic. Colder, saltier water was more dense than warm freshwater. It sank to the bottom of the world's oceans, sliding down into the subterranean canyons the way glaciers slid between the peaks of high mountain ranges. At the bottom of every ocean were frigid pools and briny currents. Oceanographers considered them rivers because as they crept across the globe, they refused to mix with the rest of the sea. As the remora entered the canyon, Gemme turned on the lights, sediment wafted by the camera like falling snow. 1,000 feet, she said. What depth is the remora rated for? 3,000, she said. But Joe built it, so it'll do twice that. From the sonar reading, they could see that the canyon was narrowing. Picking up the bottom, Gemme said, shall we take the full tour?
We paid for it, Paul said. Might as well go on the ride. Gamay set the Remora onto a new course.
I'm really fighting the current now, she said. I have to keep 5 degrees down angle on the thrusters just to hold the depth.
So the current is flowing up the canyon? Gamay nodded.
It's like we've entered opposite world.
Paul pointed to something on the sonar scan.
What's that?
Gamay angled toward a strange rise in the bottom of the canyon. The Remora had to fight like crazy to get near it, pushing and weaving like a bird flying into the wind. As it got closer, the target resolved into a cone-shaped rise. Crossing over it, the Remora was pushed violently to the side and then away. Before Gamay could circle back, another cone-shaped structure appeared on the scan, and then another.
What are they? Gamay asked.
I think I know, Paul said, but keep going. Traveling down the canyon and zigzagging as it widened, they found dozens upon dozens of the protruding cones. I'm moving in closer to one of them, Gamay said. Using full power, the Remora crept up to the cone. The camera focused on its edge. Small amounts of sediment were blasting out of the cone, streaming toward the surface like ash from a volcano. It's a subsurface geyser, Paul said. It's venting water.
Geothermal?
Has to be.
Let's get over the top, Gamay said.
It'll give us an idea of how much water is being ejected and allow us to get a direct sample.
Great idea, Paul said.
She maneuvered the Remora up and over the very center of the cone. The submersible was immediately caught in the grips of the outflow. The view spun as the craft was thrust violently upward and outward, rising like a scrap of paper caught in the breeze on a hot summer day. Gamay maneuvered the submarine away from the rising column of water and got it back under control. The water in that plume is nearly 200 degrees, she said, checking the readings. Salinity is zero. Paul sat back and scratched his head. I've never seen anything like this.
Black smokers on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, she suggested.
Not the same, he said. They vent toxic sludge, high in sulfur and all manner of dangerous chemicals. Basically, volcanic soot. From the look of this chemical profile, you could bottle that water once it cooled down.
Keep it hot and we could make coffee with it, she joked.
Now you're talking, he said. How many cones did you count before we stopped looking?
At least 50, she said.
Let's see if there are any more. She redirected the Remora once again, and it traveled down the canyon for another 20 minutes. They counted more than 100 cones. There seemed to be no end to them. Picking up a source of iron, Gamay said, checking the magnetometer. But we're starting to lose the signal.
Head toward it, Paul said. We're getting close to maximum transmission range. We're going to lose the ROV any minute.
She adjusted course once more, but the image on screen began to glitch as pixels dropped out and the transmission became garbled. The view froze and then cleared.
Hang in there, Paul urged.
Bottom coming up, Gamay said. The screen froze once more and then cleared just as the Remora crashed into the sediment pile.
You've hit bottom, Paul said.
Gamay was already adjusting the controls.
No backseat drivers, thank you.
The impact caused a momentary blackout, but the link reset after several anxious moments. As the view resolved, the camera focused on a tangle of metallic wreckage.
Something else was down there, Paul said.
It looks structural to me, she said. Twisted steel plating and pipes were clearly visible. Whatever it had once been, it was now half-buried. Gamay adjusted the lights and then panned and zoomed the camera. The video flickered and a new sight appeared.
That's an arm.
It was white in appearance and stretching away from the camera. It looked like colorless, bleached flesh, but the shape was too perfect and consistent, and the Remora's lights reflected off its polished surface. At the end of the arm, they found a hand and mechanical fingers.
Interesting.
As the ROV hovered, its thrusters scoured away the loose sediment. A shoulder came into view next, and then a face appeared from beneath the silt. Perfectly shaped and porcelain white, it filled the screen. It was like unearthing a statue of Athena. "She's beautiful," Paul said. "She's a machine," Gemme replied.